in the days of yore, approximately 2,000 years ago to be specific, there lived on earth the greatest teacher. And just to introduce this class, I would like to describe to you several of his students. And I want you to name the student. I'm not going to tell his name. You tell me his name quick after you hear the description. One of the students this teacher taught was quick to speak. And once he said, "It is good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for thee and one for Moses and one for Elias," not knowing what he said. He was impulsive. He was vacillating. He made bold declarations of confidence and belief in his teacher. But when his teacher was captured and facing an unjust court, he cursed and swore he did not know his teacher. Who was he? Peter. Did the teacher love Peter? He surely did. He loved him and he patiently persisted in teaching this unlovely student until he had made something lovely out of him. These students were brothers. They were hot-tempered. And so the teacher named them sons of thunder. And at one point the teacher had to restrain their anger lest they call fire down on an unsuspecting village of people. And one time the mother of these two odious students, Manu, and the students themselves had the audacity and the impudence to beg a special position from their teacher. And it rankled their fellow students. Who was it? James and John. Did the teacher love the sons of thunder? He surely did. He loved them and patiently persisted in teaching these unlovely students until he had made something lovely of them. And I think James, the son of Zebedee, if I remember correctly, was the first one to be martyred for his faith. Son of thunder. This student was a slow learner. He did, however, have great fealty for his teacher. Once he told his fellow students, "Let us go that we may die with him." And then later he asked his teacher, "Lord, we know not whither thou goest, and how can we know the way?" And after it was declared that his teacher was living again, this slow student declared, "Except I shall see and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe." And the teacher appeared to him and chided him, saying, "Be not faithless, but believing." Who was he? Did the teacher love Thomas? He surely did. He loved him and patiently persisted in teaching this unlovely student until he made something lovely out of him. And then, you remember that impulsive, vacillating student at the beginning? He had a brother, and his brother was the golden student who must have inherited all the refined characteristics that his other brother missed. He seems to have been a quiet student, the kind that did not cause the teacher any trouble. He was a trusting student who had quiet confidence in his teacher. And though he could not understand how everything would work out, he came to his teacher and said, "There's a lad here that has five barley loaves and two small fishes. But what are they among so many?" He was eager to learn. He asked his teacher along with some other students, "Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign when all these things shall be fulfilled?" Who was he? Andrew. Did the teacher love Andrew? He surely did. Did he give him special favors? Not that I know of. There were some of the Jesus students who did have some special privileges, it seems, but he loved Andrew and patiently persisted in teaching the lovely student until he had made something lovelier of him. And then the greatest teacher had a student who was an extremely unlovely student. And while three of the teacher's students had special favors, as I mentioned, it seems, they had special opportunities. For example, three of them got to be on the Mount of Transfiguration with Jesus. Jesus gave this unlovely student a special opportunity. He gave him the trust of caring for their finances. And he was a thief. Despite the fact that he was a thief. And the teacher tried to show special love for him. He gave him the sop at the Passover meal. A special token of love. And if you ever lived in Ethiopia, you would know a little bit about that. When someone takes the injera, this large pancake that they eat with, and tears a piece off and gathers a morsel of food together and puts it into your mouth for you. That's a special token of love. And Jesus did that for Judas, something similar. Yet this unthankful student loved money more than his teacher. And he sold his teacher into the hands of wicked men. And when the student came to do his dastardly deed of betraying his teacher, the teacher said with great feeling, "Friend, wherefore art thou come?" And this ungrateful student left the teacher's love roll off his back like water off a duck's back. And though the teacher would gladly have forgiven him and restored him to favor, in his misery he went out and hanged himself. Who was he?
Judas.
Did the teacher love Judas? The greatest of all teachers felt the pangs of losing a student whom he had so lovingly invested in. An unlovely student who refused to allow the teacher's love to make him lovely. I think you mentioned something about that in our prayer meeting this morning. Now let's go back to this impulsive student, Peter, whom the Lord made lovelier. And one day the greatest teacher gave this student teacher, Peter, an assignment. Wasn't ready for his assignment. And so the greatest teacher had to give his student teacher a special vision to prepare him for his assignment. He sent him to teach whom this teacher would have considered unlovely. And when he arrived at his student's house, the student fell down on his face to worship him. And what did he do? He reached down and raised up that dog of a Gentile to be his equal. He loved that unlovely student as his teacher had loved him. And do you know what he said when he was addressing the students in the house that day? "Of a truth, I perceive that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him." Are there any students of the greatest teacher here who have been assigned to teach others? I expect you're all teachers. But you're students of the greater teacher, the greatest teacher. Are you lovely or unlovely? Are you, which of those students I described are you? Will you be made lovely? And will you accept the responsibility to take unlovely students that the greatest teacher gives you and help them to become lovely? So let's go into our question. Well, I did want to read this yet. How many of you are familiar with the book Good Morning, Miss Dove? Some of you are. If you have opportunity to get one, it's an interesting book. You may have to use some the literary sleuth or somebody like that to find you one of these. There are things in here that are not appropriate. You do need to spit out some things and maybe skip over some things. But all the signs had been against William. He came from a home, if one could call it a home, that might euphemistically have been described as underprivileged. He was an orphan who lived with his grandmother, a woman of unsavory repute, in a leaky shack near the gasworks. On his first day at school, he had been barefoot. There had been scabs on his toes. His hair had been matted, and over one pasty cheek had been the brownish stain of a fading bruise. He had an elbow crooked as if to ward off a blow. Mothers entering their pretty six-year-olds in Cedar Grove School had gasped. One, a Mrs. Holmes, had begged Miss Dove to keep her son on the other side of the room from William. "I believe in democracy," as she had said, "but I don't want Charlie to catch anything. My seating arrangement is alphabetical," Miss Dove had told her coldly, but privately her heart had sunk. It was wearisome enough to deal with raw but scrubbed first graders from decent families. An unwashed child from the criminal fringe of town posed a problem indeed, and then William surprised her. All the rules of manners and procedure that Miss Dove persuaded, bullied, her critics had said, the other children to accept, William took to his bosom. When he greeted Miss Dove at the door, he did so in the accents of dedication. At her attention, please, he sat up straight and showed the proud poker face of a soldier presenting arms. He began to wash. Like a badge of honor, he wore a clean handkerchief protruding from his breast pocket. Miss Dove gave him Saturday jobs, raking leaves or mowing grass. He performed these jobs well, and later on her recommendation, he procured a paper route. He was the best paper boy in town. He was never late, and he always laid the paper folded on the doorstep instead of twisting it and tossing it on the roof. What is worth doing well, Miss Dove had said, and William had taken her literally. And then at the end of the year, this teacher always went through her special book and gave a mark for each student. It was a book that only she knew, only she looked in. It was her book and her rating of the students that she taught. And she had her marks for different students. But this is what it says. But beside William Holloway's name, she placed the symbol that she might, without undue complacency or spurious modesty, have placed beside her own. It was an S. It stood for satisfactory. Well, read that book sometime. Number one, why might we be tempted to show partiality in the classroom? This is a workshop. You want me to lecture or you want to give some thoughts? Why might we be tempted to show partiality? Some are just more lovable than others. It just might be born out of disgust or irritation. There are just certain personalities that get under our skin. Any other thoughts? It could be due to the undercurrent of a grudge with a student's parents. Our reactions are a subtle revenge. But, well, maybe the student's not so hard to love, but his parents irritated you or made it difficult for you or blamed you. We may be seeking favor or popularity. Teachers don't have any trouble wanting to be popular. Well, maybe if you only have two, maybe you don't have that trouble in schools with two or three teachers. But I teach at a school where there are 16 of us on the faculty, and don't you want to be the popular one? Or at least, and if you can somehow get the favor of the right students. But then there could be some more sanctified reasons, in quotes. Fudging scores to make a student appear the way you think he is capable or not capable of doing. And that may sound strange to you about fudging scores, but let me explain. According to EMP's guidelines, and if you have an opportunity to observe students, well, with special ed work, I get to see this because I teach a whole range of grades and subjects and special needs, and I see their curriculums. A student needs to be getting a B or higher in first grade to pass first grade. If he's pulling lower B's and C's in first grade, he is going to bottom out within a few years. And the reason is because grades 1 to 3 are foundational grades. What they learn in grades 1 to 3 become the medium of learning in grades 4 and on. So that's why they must perform at a higher level. Well, the problem is that when you fill out the report card, B's and C's are acceptable in the older grades, and it's hard to make a student look realistic. So the parents are looking at their first grader's report card and, he's getting B minuses and some B's and C plus, but all right, he's about average. Yeah, it's a little low, but he's pulling. And then we get to the end of the year and the teachers are talking about maybe retaining the child or. And so how can you give a true picture? The teachers understand. You can try to explain, but there's nothing like seeing E's and F's on a report card to make it. If the parents had been seeing E's and F's all along, then they would say, oh, this is serious. Yes, we're expecting something or we need to do something. So in our schools, well, what do you do? Well, you tried to, okay, well, this actually tried to make the score look realistic. Well, at the school where I'm teaching, the business of fudging to make it really look right so that it would be right at the end or make it easier at the end just seemed too subjective, because how do you make it the same for all of them? Or how do you let, you know, partiality, you know, other factors involved? So we reworked the grading scale. We actually use three grading scales in our school. One grading scale for grade 1 and 2 maybe. Another grading scale for grade 3. And then from maybe, is it 4 and up, then another grading scale. And the teachers who did it used a mathematical formula. I wasn't involved, but they did it somewhat mathematically and tried to get it proportionate. But we use a different grading scale that grades grades 1 and 2 harder and grade 3 harder, so that if that student is indeed pulling E's and F's, that's what should be on his report card, so that it's a realistic picture. And by having the grading scale reworked, then we had a standard. Everybody, all the teachers had to use the same grading scale. It has not totally solved the problem. It's really, really hard to get E's and F's on a report card when they should be there for some reason, but it has helped a little bit. Another thing that would be more sanctified in our minds, we could think, well, we're just treating the student according to his just deserts. And it's true that children are under the law. Do you understand what I mean? Children are under the law. They're not under the gospel. The children are under the law. They have, there is penalty for their transgression. But the law is the schoolmaster to bring them to Christ, right? So they need to taste and need to learn grace and mercy. So how can we show them that? Grace and mercy. Let's go to question 2. What personality traits of ourselves or the students tempt us to be partial? Similar, but the personality traits. Now let's go with the student. What are these? We said some are more lovable. What makes a child more or less lovable? Can you just be raw and tell us frankly what they are? What?
One that doesn't make trouble.
One that doesn't make trouble would be one that we would desire. How about a trait that's unlovable? Opposite, troublemaker. Or I had a student one year who was loose-tongued and uninhibited, just yak. And he didn't have any sense of what proper questions to answer, ask, and what are improper questions. You know, if he just, you were talking about finances and whatever, and you know, he just might boldly raise his hands, well, what's your paycheck? Or, you know, just stuff that's, this is private, you know. You know, just asking, and sometimes the questions, it would have been just appropriate to be quiet. I really struggled to love him. That was an odious behavior. But later, maybe been a summer ago, his grandfather has a farm near to where I live, and they were building a new shed for their cattle, and I went over to help. We had a roof day, and I went over to help. And this boy was there. And working beside him on that roof job gave me a warm spot for him. He was not in my classroom. We were outside the classroom, but to him I was still his teacher, evidently. And he addressed me respectfully. I think he even called me by my title. Even though he was out of the classroom, he was pleasant. I saw a different side of him working with him than in the classroom, and it helped me to appreciate him more. But poor hygiene, I find that a struggle. And working with special ed children, this is an issue, because special needs children cannot always control their bodily functions well. My autistic boy drools, and when his medication changes, or they're especially, and then the drooling becomes very bad, so that he's dripping on his papers. If he stands over my desk to do something, then he's dripping on my desk. And some of his other bodily functions don't go so well sometimes, so he smells like that. And that is a challenge, you know, to be able to work with him closely and not gag. And his parents do their best. But, you know, it's so hard to get him out of bed and get him dressed and get him to school, and he doesn't always remember his handkerchief. And So, students, another thing that can really be a problem with this is an unhealthy attitude toward learning. On his part or his parents' part, school's prison. And all he can think about is tractors and trucks and farming and whatever his dad does. And we at my school is right beside a road, and the trucks like to come down through there and jake. And then when the big fence go past, and I tell them, if it's just a truck or a motorcycle, you can look at all those you want to on the way home from school on the bus. If it's a fence, I guess we'll stop and look at a fence. Maybe you don't have fence out here, but fence a big thing in my area, a German-made tractor, I think. But that can be irritating. All right, how about for the teacher? What personality traits tempt us to be partial? What traits do we have in ourselves or our own? Yeah. When we're around people struggling with selfishness, and it reminds us of our own selfishness. But do you know that, well, let's use dishonesty, for example, and hopefully teachers don't struggle with dishonesty, but do you know who a dishonest person dislikes the most? Another dishonest person. Our landlord in Ethiopia was a dishonest man, and I was present whenever my bishop sat down beside him to sign the rental contract, to renew the rental contract. And so the landlord slid over a paper in front of our bishop, brother, and he started reviewing the rental contract. And after a while, our bishop, brother, I'm admired how quick he was to pick it up. He just quietly shoved it back over and said, "Mr. Gattaccio, I'm an honest man." Oh, all right. And then he pulled out the proper papers. He was going to have us sign that we were paying only a small amount of money to evade, what, taxes maybe, or I'm not sure what all. And we couldn't sign that. We were going to sign for the proper amount of money. But then he told us that the servant he hired to be our gatekeeper was an honest man. He hired an honest gatekeeper. You can trust him. And today that gatekeeper's a brother in our church, and he's the most honest man I know of. You can send him to town with money. You don't worry a bit. He's a very honest man. Very humble and honest man. Why would a dishonest man hire an honest man? Okay. Another one would be fear of a child based on his family and his carriage. And I'm going to reveal something here. I'm going to use terminology that you should be familiar with, but conservative and progressive. Is there any struggle between conservatives and progressive in your church group? In your school? I'm human. I was raised very conservatively, as you can tell probably, but my home was very conservative. I was taught that way, and I respect that. But I had some students to teach who were related to me. Their father, in fact, was... their grandfather, in fact, was my uncle. And his home was progressive and loose. And these young fellows were related to me, and they had a very dignified and cool bearing, and they were not as conservative as I was, but I was afraid of them. You know, I was afraid they were going to laugh at me or make fun of me. But I really struggled to relate to them and to really call them an account. They were the kind that... The one was especially well-behaved, but the other one seemed to be secretive and kind of sneaky. It was hard for me to call him into account because, oh well, you know, especially the relationship there. And then I had a fear of parental reaction. One year I had a boy who wanted to bat cross-handed. He would cross his hands to bat, and he could bat harder that way for some reason. He could hit terrific balls cross-handed, but if he held his hands like you would normally hold a bat, it didn't go so well. Well, for myself, it wasn't an issue, letting bat cross-handed. But I was working with a co-teacher, and my co-teacher was a little bit like Miss Dove, if you know Miss Dove and you read it. She was a very firm but pleasant teacher whom everything was in order, and she taught for years. She was a good teacher, and the students loved her, but she was firm in her opinions. And her dad knew that there were people who had broken wrists batting cross-handed. And so it was her rule that when she was playing with the students, he dare not bat cross-handed. What was I to do? I was a junior teacher to her, and I had to relate to the same students. So, all right, well then, when I'm teacher, that's the rule too, I guess. He may not bat cross-handed. I thought it was unnecessary. But so one day, and he knew the rule, one day he got up to bat, and he had his hands properly on the bat, but just before he hit, he switched his wrist and batted. And I said, out! He disobeyed. That night his mother called, and I was in trouble. Thankfully, I had had warning about what to do in cases like that, and I just very meekly told her, well, I'm sorry, if you have a complaint about what happened, you need to go through the school board. But do you think there would be any temptation to not love? Fear of parental reaction. And then family status. I'm glad your communities don't struggle with family status. But, you know, the poor manager family, the one that has quacky health practices. The one where they struggle with mental illness. And it should not affect teachers. Should it? And I disagree with that parent's philosophy on child training and medication and dietary and health options and their home schedule or lack of it. But I, with my special needs, I relate to children and medication in a real way. And it's not in my power. When the medication changes on my autistic boy, it's not mine to say whether the parents should have changed it or the doctor should have changed it and whether the dose is right and whether, and if he comes to school and he's just drugged and can hardly keep his eyes open, well, it's out of my realm. I can communicate with the parents, but I do struggle with that. Now, question three, what are some symptoms to warn us that maybe we're being partial so that we know if we are or not? How do you know if you're being partial toward a student or not? Well, do we attack a person about something he cannot help? When we discipline or correct, it should be based on his conduct and not, there should not be a slur in it about his family or his looks or his idiosyncrasy. In our correction, you know how it is, especially if we get irritated, we can make a slur or something against something he cannot help. We need to correct his conduct but not attack his person. Do we have feelings of retaliation or malice in our discipline? Now's my chance to set him straight. Do you ever get those feelings, those urges? That class clown now? This is one time I can just sock him down a little bit. We need to discipline him, but when we start getting those feelings, I'm going to even the score here. Watch out. And when we start trying to impress, all right, I'm trying to impress that student. Beware of the attitude, I'm going to impress. What language are we using in correction? I was talking about that, but our correction should be firm and controlled rather than sharp and scathing. Maybe you don't have that trouble, but I'm a little bit sharp with my voice. And it's pretty easy for me I'm going to give an example here. It comes to my mind right now, so maybe I should give it and then we can talk about it later. But one day when working with eighth graders, you know, a little humor is good sometimes. But one day I cut a dry joke, and this boy that I was talking about earlier he just, right out loud, hee-haw! Well, you know, it was appropriate to laugh a little bit, but that was very, I don't know, it was rude and just, it was annoying to me. And my response was, and this was an eighth grader, this wouldn't have the same effect in grade three. But in grade eight, I just said, stand up so we can look at you. So he stood up and everybody looked at him. Now we'll talk about later whether that was appropriate. Do we always accept certain students' suggestions, songs, or game choices and tend to refuse others? Do some students get by with infractions that others do not? Or some students get commendation and others do not? Do we show mercy impartially? There are times, if you were in my room, especially a high school room, you would hear me say, "Blessed are the merciful." I would say that. So the student raised his hand. "I didn't get my assignment finished." Well, there, I have a penalty for that. But there are times where, for some reason or another, there seems to be a legitimate reason why it didn't happen, and they hear me say, "Well, I guess, blessed are the merciful." And the students chuckle a little bit and we go on, but do we do that for everybody, not just, well, the ones we like? Or question 4, is there any place for adjusting the severity of a punishment based on the offender? Any place for adjusting the severity of the punishment based on the offender? A principle that our, a guideline that our principal recently gave us in faculty meeting is that when dealing out punishments, consistent punishment is better than escalating punishment. Especially if you're working to break annoying habits or correcting carelessness in work or something. You know, the temptation is, well, I punished, and then we're still not getting what we want, so make it a little heavier and a little heavier and a little heavier. And there are some times that that's all right. But in general, the underlying principle is just keep at it. Just keep at it. Have your standard punishment. And if it doesn't seem to be working, don't worry about it. Just keep at it. Consistently keep going. And eventually the effect will be seen. But Luke 12, 47 and 48, you know the verses where Jesus said to whom more is given, more is required, and so forth. There is a principle that knowledge and opportunity do increase accountability. And there is some place for increasing the penalty for repeated offenses within reason, especially for moral transgression. Deliberate mischief or deliberately disorderly conduct or persistent rebellion or repeated unkindness toward fellow students, what I would call repeated moral transgression, there's a place for increasing the punishment. So you did a small thing. So 15 minutes off phys ed for this. And well, it happens again. Well, then it's going to be the whole phys ed the next time maybe. And eventually it might reach to something. Well, then you have to take your note home to sign for your dad to sign or something like that. I would say the increasing severity has to do with moral transgression more than late homework and that. That a consistent, just keep at it. But you have to be careful or you can cross the bounds of justice. Children generally will accept and respect justice. They feel secure with justice. But unkindness and injustice will foster anger, bitterness, and disrespect. So you don't need to fear that correcting children they're not going to like. In fact, they will respect you for when you correct them, if you are just. But they know whenever you were angry and you just flew off the handle and said, "All right, well then I'm just going to dump the whole load on you then." They know that, and that fosters the wrong thing. But we need to be careful then that our punishments are based on, well, so I said the offender, it's based on his repeated transgression, not because he's one I don't like. Well, I make that distinction with late homework, for example. You know if a student's careless or not. Or if this student, for example, the one boy I had was an adopted boy and he was on medication so he could keep calm and controlled. And he was slow moving and had trouble focusing, and he was definitely handicapped. It wasn't made up. Well, that boy, when his homework was not completed, I had more mercy on him than I would have a quick student that was careless. So there you see, I'm showing partiality. And the students know that. But I think the students in that room understood that this boy has a need. That they understand justice. There is a place for tactfulness, but beware of witty correction. I've gotten in trouble with witty correction. All right, question 5. Is there a place for giving students different levels of responsibility? Every student should sense that he has a place and a contribution to make in the classroom. Every child deserves to do something for his teacher sometime. But in our upper grade rooms at Paradise, we make a school newspaper for the school. The upper graders produce a school newspaper for the school several times a year. And there are certain students selected to do certain jobs on that paper. They try to give every student a job of some sort. But a student who works on the school newspaper must be a student who's able to handle the workload of his normal lessons plus have time to, you know, work on the newspaper. So you can't give every student equal jobs in that case. They can't all handle the same load. So what about that? Well, Jesus dispensed talents according to ability, didn't he? So two things that determine what responsibility is based on. Responsibility is based on, number one, ability, and number two, trust. Some students you can't trust out of your sight down in the office photocopying. So some you can. So the ones you can trust do get to be out of your sight. But if we only ever gave special jobs to those who have their work finished, or whom we know will get their work finished, or even whom we could trust, there would be some children that might not get a job. So no student should never have a job. I think it's occasional. You need to think of something you can give them to. Number 6, what thought patterns or attitudes can help us to avoid or overcome partiality? And here's where I wanted to read some more from this book. What thought patterns or attitudes can help us to avoid or overcome partiality? Page 18. The pastor's son had cursed in Miss Dove's room, and that was forbidden. And so he knew she heard him curse. And so the students were dismissed. For an instant, Miss Dove was tempted to let David go with the others, to excuse him with a reprimand, or at least to defer his punishment until the next day, if she could rest during the whole lunch hour, sitting perfectly still and even. Well, you understand, this lady was battling with a health problem, which was a foreign thing to her, and so right now she's not feeling well, and she's going to let him go. She thought she should, even though the notion was unorthodox, putting her head down upon her desk. If you know Miss Dove, that was a very unorthodox thing. But no, David's character was in her keeping. Miss Dove looked at David. Her gaze was not contemptuous, not impressed. She saw no hero in the aisle, and no monster either. She saw a 9-year-old boy who had gone a little further than he now wished he had. And if I remember what she did to him, she did what she probably did to others who did such things. He had to go wash his mouth out with soap. Our students' character is in our keeping. They're not monsters or heroes. They're just little children that did the wrong thing, and we're responsible to train them. I pray not for the world, but for them which thou hast given me, for they are thine, and all mine are thine, and thine are mine, and I am glorified in them. That's an attitude. The Lord gave them to you, and so they're His, and now they're yours also. Maintain teacher dignity and equanimity. We should be predictable. Students should be able to know and expect to a measure how we will respond to issues that arise. Be firm, but not reactive. And here's another thing that helps me. Call your grown-up struggles, failures, conflicts, and personality quirks, whatever you struggle with, call them by the same name that you call your students. I have had one time in particular, I can remember driving home, and I was having a particular struggle and problem that day, and it hit me on my way home that this is exactly what I was dealing with in my student. It's the same name. It's just a grown-up version of it, but it's pride or it's selfishness. And when you just, since you're in your vehicle alone and they're not hearing, you can just say, well, you know, the problem is I'm proud. And I was just like that student I dealt with today. I've had that help me with my practical. Now, number seven, what practical classroom methods can we use to help us avoid partiality? And here, a practical thing is, have standard punishments to match offenses. I would like to read to you mine for the eighth grade. I made a list here of standard punishments to match offenses. Now, I have to admit that on the spur of the moment, I don't always remember that I have this list, and I do things sometimes, and it's not on the list. But by having the list there, it's sort of a check. But for minor offenses, this is what I'll do for minor offenses in eighth grade. A stern look and eyes fixed on that person. Just, and you can do that while you're teaching too. You just keep looking. Every second you're looking at that person. And that can take care of a lot of things. A public rebuke. But be careful with public rebukes that your words are kind. But, you know, that's uncalled for back there. That wasn't unkind. It was a public rebuke. But, or sit still, or, you know, you can do public rebukes in a proper way. Or send them outside the room, or move them to the front desk, or just go back and stand beside them. Just for a minor, just eighth graders, well, it's just kind of different having a teacher real close, you know. So you just get real, real close and just stand there for a while. And it's amazing how they dissolve and just melt down. Or a private meeting in my room. Since I'm a special ed teacher and I just go in to teach two classes in their room, then I could say, well, you come down to my room tomorrow morning and I want to talk to you. That's a little scary. Now, what about repeated or major offenses? Sit beside me in front of the room. I've had that already. Well, if you're just going to repeatedly cause trouble, well, you know what dads do when their son's causing trouble? Here, you can sit beside me for a while. So you may come up here and face the chalkboard, and here, sit beside me for a while. And each year I've had about one student there for a while that I did that to, and it worked. I mean, it cured things really fast. Write sentences during phys ed. Make a public confession and apology to the class. I think it's appropriate if it's a public transgression and everybody knew it and it was intentionally disruptive to make the student just stand up and say, I'm sorry, I disrupted the class. That they need to face their transgression. It was public and we can't take all the pain out of punishment. Miss a break, and then if it's a persistent offense, send a note home for the parents or get principal help. I already told you about our grading scale. That was to help standardize some things. Another thing you can help is try to greet each student by name or look each student in the face. I have made it my practice this past year when I walk in, and when I started teaching high school, I was afraid of my students and I had trouble looking at them. So this past year, I made it a practice. I would walk in the room and the first thing I would do, I would start off row one and I would look every student in the face. If he weren't looking, I'd just stand there and stare at him until his head came out from behind his desk and peeped up at me and smile at him. And then go to row two. And I just spent about 2 minutes just going across the room and just looking at each one in their face. Order, it gave me better order. And you know, when you look at each other and smile, eye to eye contact, it's disarming. It breaks down the fronts. It takes away feelings of unloveliness. Just look at that boy and smile. It's hard to do. It is hard to smile in the face of an eighth grader. Especially if it's one that you're having a little bit of tension with. It's hard. But it'll work. Now this boy that I said hee-haw, he said hee-haw and I said stand up so you can look at, we can look at you. Well, my personal opinion in that was an all right correction because he made a public, embarrassing, disrespectful reaction. So he should bear the shame of that. That was all right. But one other day, I corrected him with a public remark, and I don't remember exactly what I said, but I attacked his person. I do remember that in my public correction, I made a scathing remark about his person. And I felt condemned after that. And the next morning, I went to him, and I called him outside the door, and I said, you needed correction, and it was all right for me to correct you, but I should not have attacked your person like that publicly. I'm sorry. And he accepted the apology. I didn't want him to think I was backing down and accepting what he had done. That wasn't the point, but I had gone about it in a wrong manner. respect the home's boundaries. And I already talked some about impartiality in grading, but I like to look through my eighth graders' Bible workbooks to make sure that they're staying neat and that they're something that when they're 40 they can pull out of their closet and look at with their companion if they're married by then and enjoy. This is what I did in eighth grade. And I explained to them, I don't want you to feel embarrassed about it. I want you to be able to pull it out and say, look what I did in eighth grade. Well, how do you? And I put ratings in. I have my little marks that I put in there so they know what I thought and what the requirement is, what needs to change. And I put a little code there so I can come back later and see what I told them and whether it's making. But I try to do that without looking whose it is first, generally. Sometimes I look, well, who is that? Because I don't recognize their handwriting because I'm not their homeroom teacher. But I like to see if I can't make those marks before I know whose book I'm looking at. Because when I know whose book it is, no wonder. But then there's the other kind. Let them off. It's time to quit, but let's just quickly. Number 9, how can we help students to love impartially? I'll let that go. Number 10, what should a teacher do if he's blamed for being partial? I'm here to say that if you are a teacher, it is nearly impossible for you to administrate so fairly and so rightly that nobody, no student, no parent, no one's going to ever accuse you that you were partial. That's almost impossible. If you've gotten that accomplished, well, good. But what should you do if you're blamed for being partial? The children might say, she just left him by her. Teacher pet. The children will, if nobody else will. At least in about 6th and 7th grade, they will. What should you do? It is not possible to treat every student equally because not every child is working with the same difficulties in the same situation. And they don't know all the things that affected your decision. But you will try to treat them fairly. And it's good to, if we get criticized, to evaluate, was I being partial or wasn't I? And we don't need to go on a guilt trip, but it could cost. We can keep it in mind at least. But don't take it personally. And if a parent blames you for always being partial with their child, try to work with it, work through the school board, but don't take it too hard. I say never argue with the umpire. When I'm on the playground, if I'm the umpire or if a student's the umpire, you never argue with the umpire. And there's no way to call every shot perfectly. So they can, he said that was out the last time and this time he left it slide. The umpire's always right. They might as well learn that because people have actually blamed God for being partial and we know better than that. You're dismissed. Thank you. Yeah.